Good afternoon, everybody. I'll be focusing on another dimension of exclusion, which largely gets overlooked in mainstream debates around education and development. That is the role and participation of children with disabilities. So can I just first of all start off by saying what a pleasure it is to be here and what an honor it is to be here and be part of the deliberations here, especially when one's talking about mainstream issues such as gender, et cetera, and the role of disability and all that. What I will be doing is I'll be focusing on data that was gathered as part of the RECOUP project, which Madeline has already mentioned in her previous presentation. The project I will be talking about is the Disability Education and Poverty Project, which is again looking at the role and participation and outcomes of education for children with disabilities in countries of India, Pakistan, Ghana, and Kenya. For the purposes of today's presentation, I'll be focusing primarily on the country context of Ghana and trying to present some insights from there. So you'll have to bear with me with some figures, really, to begin with, just to provide an overview of the context, country context, in relation to disability and education. And I think this report from the Ministry of Education, Sports and Sciences in Ghana, 2008, really encapsulates to some extent the position of children with disabilities, or what they synonymously use as children with special education needs. There is very limited information about the incidence of children with special education needs around the country, is what it states. And indeed, figures that are available are extremely unreliable. Most of the calculation of the total number of population of disabled people in the country is based on the WHO figures. So it's believed there are approximately 2.3 million people with disabilities in Ghana, and I'll not even go into defining or trying to define what they mean by disability here. That in itself is a hugely contentious and multidimensional construct. If you take the figure of 2.3 million people with disabilities within the age group of 2 to 9 years, the National Sample Survey of Ghana 2009 puts the figure as 16% of children have some form of disability. Now, that is a substantial number. Ghana has not really focused much legislatively on the rights of people with disabilities, but it did pass the Ghana Disability Rights Act in 2006, and it was nearly a 20-year struggle by different lobby groups, etc., to make this possible. But it is there, and there is now a legislative anchoring in the system, so-called implementation is a different factor. Regarding participation rates in education, not surprisingly, enrollment rates, progression rates, completion rates are extremely low for people with children with disabilities. Figures across the southern context vary around 2% to 3%, and the case will be similar for Ghana in terms of access to formal education for children with disabilities. Very briefly, it has a two-track system. We have a mainstream school system and a special education school system. The current emphasis, especially for the past decade or little more, has been on mainstreaming, or something which few of you are familiar with, the whole global construct and movement towards inclusive education. Again, I'll try not to deconstruct that because that's contentious in itself, but there's been more and more emphasis in bringing children with disabilities into the mainstream setting. Not surprisingly, gender-specific data is not available, so you don't know how many girls with disabilities or men with disabilities are in the education system. Given the context, given disability is hardly acknowledged in the education system, why did we want to focus on disabled people? Well, the basic premise in RECOUP was this. There is research to suggest that there is a growing cyclical relationship between disability and poverty. That is, disabled people are more likely to be overrepresented amongst the poor in developing economies. And this is not really surprising, because if you're disabled, you're more likely to be excluded from employment, you're more likely to be excluded from other labor market opportunities, pushing you into poverty. And if you're poor, you're more likely to be living in areas with low sanitation, hence making you much more capable of picking up various diseases leading to impairment. You're also more likely to be working in hazardous scenarios where you might get an impairment because of a body injury, etc., and hence you're likely to become disabled and the cycle continues. So it's really important to understand what role does education have, if any, and helping breaking the cycle of disability and poverty? Can it make a difference? Well, the questions which we tried to address in our research, which was part of the consortium, so 5 years across the 4 countries, was this. Does education, as currently experienced by the young people with disabilities, enhance their ability to develop valuable functional skills? And secondly, and rather importantly, to become aware of available resources, and really crucially, are they able to convert these into usable opportunities? Well, I'm not really even going to attempt to try and answer these two questions here within the brief time I have, but what I'll try and do over the next few minutes or so is trying to give you a flavor of the findings which are relevant to the audience and the kind of discussions we are having here. So just throwing some figures out there, just to give you an idea of the kind of a sample we were working with. This was very much a community-based study, and as Madeline said, like YGC, it was a very much a voice-based research. We were really keen and committed to listening to the voices of the young people with disabilities. Now, invariably, research with disabled people tends to be done through proxies. You go and ask the parent what they think the child is struggling with. You go and ask the teacher to see how the child is struggling within the school. We wanted to engage with young people of 15 to 30 years to try and understand their life histories, how they had experienced education, how they were experiencing participation in the economic sphere, the social sphere, the family sphere, what were their notions of self. We were committed to listening to their stories from their perspective. We focused on 3 dimensions of impairment, indeed a very medical approach, but we decided for simplistic reasons go for visual impairment, hearing impairment, and physically impaired people with disability in the sample. And the reason being that historically these 3 groups have had some sort of a educational provision in place. So it was like a good case scenario. So let's see what's available for them and how it's impacting on their lives to be able to save others. We wanted an equal number of young men and women in a sample. What we landed up with was 16 men and 7 women in Ghana. This was rather interesting. Not only did we have a lot of difficulty finding young women with disabilities who had reached high levels of schooling, but finding young women with disabilities itself was rather difficult. Even though we relied on rather innovative community-based approaches, asking key respondents, etc., we were unable to identify women with disabilities. And largely, as a result of follow-up interviews, etc., with community leaders, it seems stigma seems to be a huge issue there. But one can't really say much about that. What it's telling here is that the young women, whatever little sample we had, did not access very high levels of secondary and tertiary schooling. They were largely disadvantaged from accessing and progressing through the school system. What is, however, interesting is this: most of the young people came from families where parents were themselves not educated, so they were first-generation learners to a large extent. So that's the kind of a sample we are talking about here. So we conducted in-depth interviews with them, tried to focus on what they had experienced in school, and during those conversations, we were very interested in understanding their access and indeed their participation within the school setting. And what's really interesting, when talking about difficulties in terms of entry or accessing school-specific issues, they were not gender-specific and also resonate with a lot of things that have been talked about the previous presenters when you're talking about access to schooling for girls generally. So issues around commuting to school, which Chris raised in his presentation, which was absolutely pertinent for young men and women with physical impairment. Inability or reluctance of the family to pay the fee. Education was undervalued by the family, is what the young people were saying. And education, particularly for young children with disabilities, was undervalued. It wasn't seen as delivering anything worthwhile. The emphasis for these young people was on religious education, as propagated by the family. When in school, they raised a lot of difficulties. They recollected really, to some extent, horrific accounts of what happened then when they were in school, how they were the difficulties they had in accessing the curriculum, how they felt excluded within an included setting, they were unable to follow lessons, they had no support at home, there were no specialist teachers. So we had young men with visual impairment who had progressed through the school system despite these difficulties. They talked about how they relied on peer groups for support in terms of verbal writing down lessons, etc., because there was no braille available. Also, they talked about corporal punishment. That was a huge issue. Exactly, I'm sure that's true generally also, at least it is in India. But what they were also saying, it's not just disability, but poverty too was an important factor in becoming a barrier to accessing education. And this is a quote from a young woman with visual impairment who talks about the fact that she was fostered and hence was unable to access the school system. But what is really interesting to know is that all of them had this incredible faith in education. So irrespective of the fact they had been to school or not been to school, they talked about education in the terms of delivering a better life. So this is a quote from a young woman who was a beggar on the street, but she had this incredible faith in the fact that if she had been educated, then she would not have to come out and beg. And that schooling is good, and schooling allows you to deliver this economic well-being. And she was very strongly relating to this. However, what was happening in reality was a heightened invisibility for these young people. Out of the 23 people in our sample, only two were in gainful employment, at steady employment. Rest of them were either unemployed or engaged in begging. There was heightened invisibility in the social sphere. This young woman is talking about a young girl. This mother is talking about a young girl. Muna cannot do anything or take part in activities outside the house as people cannot communicate with her. So she doesn't move out of the house. Her life was extremely restricted geographically and socially. What we also tried to unpack was this whole notion of gender and disability. So we're very interested in understanding how did they, the young people, perceive this intersectionality between gender and disability. And we asked them questions around, so what were their gendered experiences of being disabled? And did that have an impact if you're a man or a woman? And again, it resonates with a lot of things that have come up in the morning session. Men tend to say that women have it somewhat easy because able-bodied men will marry them. Okay, and then they can be taken care of. They can rely on them for support. But some did acknowledge that after marrying them, they'll have harsh childcare responsibilities. They also acknowledged that being a patriarchal society, men with disabilities are better placed than women with disabilities. But women were not very verbose in what they were reflecting. They were basically saying, you know, actually men have it a little difficult because they cannot take care of their families, men with disabilities. They cannot go out and earn, so they cannot actually fulfill the socially ascribed roles, and hence they are more in a more excluded or discriminatory position. But I think this quote really encapsulates the continuous discrimination and exclusion of people with disabilities, not just in Ghana, in many of the Commonwealth countries we are aware of. However, in spite of all this, there were the young women and men whose narratives were talking about the fact that they were striving for some kind of a recognition and responsibility. Aziz Matinu really talked about the fact that education, and he was a very well-educated man within the sample, which was rather rare for us to find, education, speaking specifically in relation to people with disabilities, should be directed towards helping them know their rights, acquire employment and management skills, and all other relevant skills required to enable them to play active roles in the communities. There was a strong urge to take on responsibility and participate in society. That was extremely important amongst the educated and also amongst the not so educated. So this is husband of Adisha Shah, who I've mentioned before, who was uneducated, was a beggar, but this is what her husband had to say. Society's attitudes towards disability is not all that good because sometimes she would like to do something, and what they say is, no, 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 she can't do it, so people should help her, not knowing that if they allow her, she can equally do the same, and this is the problem. So really wanting to be part, I don't know, I might be taking extrapolating what Madeline's saying, but wanting to have a citizenship role, sort of be part of the system, be situated there. Contrast this with this. This is my last slide, so more or less there. National policy Youth Policy of Ghana 2010, this is what it says about disability. Sorry. The first quote. First, I must acknowledge that having youth with disabilities in the policy itself is a very strong assertion, but this is what it says about youth with disability. Uphold society's responsibility towards youth with disability and difficult health circumstances. It's saying the society is responsible. There's sort of a notion that they're not participants, contrasted with the female youth, where it says on, goes on to say a lot of things and ends by equal partners in the national development agenda. Indeed, uncoupling these two is very difficult. Uncoupling, one must remember that disabilities is not a homogeneous term. Again, something Elaine was talking about, gender seems to be seen as a very homogeneous grouping. It's not. Not only is that not acknowledged, but the way young people with disabilities are being framed as seen as a responsibility of the society rather than as equal partners in society is extremely essential. So, need for systemic reforms, need to move beyond responsibility to equal partnership, need to find channels to be able to help that happen. And on that note, I'm going to end. I can see the red flag there. Thank you, Tasneem.